Good day. Today is Saturday, 7th March 2026. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched or listened to this programme, or whichever part of the programme you want to watch or listen to, you decide that you like what you've seen and heard and wish to indicate that fact. Anyway, with that, let me now turn to the topic under discussion, which will be, of course, mostly the situation in the conflict between the United States and Iran. But also, I will touch at the end of this programme with the situation in the conflict in Ukraine and some very important comments which have just been made by the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov. Now, over the course of the last 24 hours, the most important information, in my opinion, is twofold. Firstly, the continued rise in the price of oil. The Straits of Hormuz remain closed. There is no shipping passing through the Straits of Hormuz. The oil price in most markets rose on Friday night above $90 a barrel. I understand the indications this morning are that oil prices are continuing to rise. If current trends continue, then at some point over the course of the next few days, the price of oil will be around $100 a barrel. And I'm going to say something here about my own experiences in these matters. I've never been a market trader myself. I've never been involved in trading in commodities, which is a particularly challenging form of market trading, just to say. But my own experience tells me that if a particular threshold is reached, which is often, if I may say so, a psychological one, like $100 per barrel for a price of oil, then that does in itself have an effect on markets. And if markets break through that barrier, if we get $100 a barrel oil, then before the market adjusts and finds a perhaps more rational market price, you will see a price surge, and the price of oil will continue to rise and perhaps continue to do so for a few more weeks until the underlying situation, the situation in the Gulf of Hormuz, resolves itself. So if we continue to see price increases next week, and all the indications at the moment suggest that we will, then, as I said, we're going to see a major surge in oil prices over the next few weeks. I'm going to return to this topic in more detail shortly. But there's also been another piece of news, or maybe more properly one should call it a claim, because of course the source that has provided us with this news, which is the Washington Post, which ultimately means the US intelligence community, is, to say it mildly, a deeply tarnished and very untrustworthy source. But anyway, yesterday the Washington Post carried an article saying that the sophistication of Iran's various drone and missile strikes across the Middle East, the accurate targeting of American bases, the destruction caused thereby, that all of this was the result of intelligence assistance being provided by Russia. And, well, there's talk about how this is Moscow's revenge for US intelligence assistance to Ukraine. There's all kinds of claims that Iran does not have the sophisticated satellite surveillance capabilities to be able to track and observe American military bases as closely as attacks of this kind would require, and that the Russians do possess all of these capabilities, and it is they most probably who are providing this assistance to Iran, and that this explains why the Iranian strikes have been as effective as they have up to now been. Now, there's a number of things to say about this. First of all, this is an admission that the Iranian strikes have indeed been effective, and that the effectiveness of these strikes has taken the United States by surprise. Now, I think that is the single most important point to make at this point. The one thing we can be relatively confident about, which is that the United States obviously did not provide, did not expect such accuracy and such effectiveness from the Iranian missile and drone strikes, because if it had, it would have taken more precautions, or perhaps conceivably avoided getting into the conflict in the first place, and above all, that it would not be making the excuses about Russian involvement which it is currently making. I am not familiar with the full range of Iranian capabilities. Iran, as I've discussed in many programs, is a much more sophisticated society than many people in the West imagine. It has a significant industrial base. It has a significant technology base, though no one, least of all the Iranians, claim that it is comparable to that of the United States. Nonetheless, the possibility that the Iranians had more capabilities of their own before they launched these missile and drone strikes than the United States anticipated, I think cannot be excluded. And it may be that part of the reason for the accuracy of these missile and drone strikes is because the Iranians are better organized and more capable in this regard than the Americans expected. After all, the Iranians have been building up their drone and missile capabilities for a long time. They have been aware of the existence of these American bases for a long time. It would be logical to assume that they would be taking steps to inform themselves about the whereabouts of these bases and the facilities in these bases, and that they would have been preparing for this kind of attack over an extended period. So I think that must be said, because it's not being said. It might be wrong to give credit to everything that we are seeing to the Russians, or if you take an American perspective, to put the blame for all that we are seeing on the Russians. And of course, the United States, the intelligence community, the people who've been briefing the Washington Post, say a great deal less about China. China has actually more extensive satellite capabilities than Russia does. And China certainly is in a position to provide satellite data to Iran. And, well, the Chinese, as I've discussed in many programs, have been busy publishing detailed satellite photos of American bases for some time in ways that strongly suggest to me that they have been providing intelligence assistance to Iran. Having made these points, it is nonetheless still the case that I do believe that Iran has actually been provided with a fair amount of intelligence assistance from the Russians, and perhaps not just intelligence assistance. I received a report which I discussed some weeks ago on this channel, in a program on this channel, that the Russians have been working with the Iranians to improve the accuracy of Iranian missiles and drones. And of course, it is the Russians who mostly launch Iran's satellites. And it is with the Russians, amongst the various BRIC states, that the Iranians have been mostly interacting, rather than with, say, China, though the Iranians do have some contacts with the Chinese as well. And of course, just 2 days ago, the Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi dropped pretty obvious hints over the course of an interview that he did with the US media that Iran has been receiving help from China and Russia, and the interviewer particularly pushed him to discuss help that Iran might be receiving from Russia. And Araghchi understandably evaded giving an answer, a clear answer, but again he seemed to be implying that assistance from Russia is indeed being provided. And for the record, the Kremlin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, also said a few days ago that Russia is in constant contact with the Iranian authorities. This seemed to be mostly related to diplomacy between Russia and Iran. But constant contact might also imply military interactions. After all, Ali Larijani, Khamenei's national security advisor, the person who seems to be in overall charge of Iran's military and security response to the Israeli-American attack. Larijani visited Moscow about 2 or 3 weeks ago. He met with Putin. I spoke about how it was likely that he met with other important Russian officials as well. So if you put all this together, if you put all of these facts together, then it is likely, or so it seems to me, that Iran is getting help from the Russians, which points to this story in the Washington Post being at least in part true. Now, the Washington Post, the various commentaries in the Western media, the comments from the White House itself about this were that assistance to Iran from Russia is no big deal. The US military is very accustomed to operating in these sort of conditions. By the way, that is completely not true. I know of no condition, no situation in any recent war, certainly not since the end of the Cold War, when the Russians have been providing to adversaries of the United States the kind of intelligence and guidance assistance that they are alleged to be providing to Iran, according to this Washington Post article. This would indeed mark a significant stepping up of Russian actions since the end of the Cold War. I think one would have to go back a lot further to the period of the Cold War, to Soviet support for, say, Syria, during the 1983 confrontation with Israel, 1982-1983 confrontations with Israel and the United States, defined a time when the Russians were providing the kind of help to an American adversary that, according to the Washington Post, they are currently providing to Iran. But of course, the thing to say is that even the help that the Russians are providing now, assuming this Washington Post article is true, is probably only a foretaste of the sort of help that the Russians could provide or might provide if the conflict drags on. If instead of a 30-day war, we get a 100-day war, and then the 100-day war then starts to stretch out longer still. If Iran and the United States are still trading blows by the end of this year, or beyond that, if all Russian diplomatic efforts or the diplomatic efforts of other countries are failing to achieve a compromise, then it is likely that Russian aid will gradually increase, that the Russians will start to supply Iran with, say, radar sets and surface-to-air missiles and perhaps drone technology. The Russians have taken Iran's Shahed drones and have significantly modernized them. And though the Iranians have done the same, they too have modernized their Shahed drones. All the indications are that the Russians have taken this, as one would expect, a great deal further, and that might have significant consequences for the conduct of the war going forward. Anyway, if this war drags on, then gradually, as the Russians sense that they are gaining that Iran might be gaining the advantage, that it is not likely to collapse under the immediate blows, that Russia supplying military and undoubtedly also economic support to Iran is starting to pay off and is giving the Russians leverage over the United States, as similar aid to North Vietnam gave the Soviet Union leverage over the United States in the 1960s, then it is likely that Russian aid to Iran will grow, which will, of course, further extensively complicate this operation, and that will take this to a level far beyond what we are seeing now. And, of course, everything that I've just said about the Russians applies with equal and perhaps even greater force to the Chinese. And, of course, if the Chinese become involved in the war in that kind of way, well, the consequences for the United States from extended US military campaign could become not just critical, but potentially even catastrophic. Anyway, that information in the Washington Post is important. The information about the developing price explosion in the energy markets, that is important too. I think that the story that is doing the rounds in the media and in the television studios just before I made this program about the apology extended by President Pezeshkian to the Arab Gulf states and his reported words about Iran ending attacks on these Gulf states if no further attacks by the United States and Israel were extended from them. I think that story is far less important, much less important than the two stories I have just discussed. Now, I say all of this because, first of all, I should say that I think that there has been a very, very selective reporting of Pezeshkian's statement. Pezeshkian made all of these words over the course of an address he made to the Iranian people on state television. And he did so speaking to them as the president of Iran and as one of the three members of the interim council, which, in theory at least, is currently leading Iran. And the thing to say about this address taken as a whole, at least as it has been reported in the Iranian media, is that it was mostly, in fact overwhelmingly, a message of defiance. A few hours before, President Trump had spoken about how the only terms he would accept from the Iranians would be unconditional surrender. He wants Iran's unconditional surrender. And Pezeshkian went out of his way over the course of this address to say that that's not going to happen. Iran, as he said, is never going to surrender. The overall message was one very much of defiance, of Iran holding out, of it continuing its struggle, of it eventually punishing the aggressors, the American and Israeli enemies. This is overwhelmingly the tone of Pezeshkian's message. Now, over the course of these words, Pezeshkian did say that Iran did not seek conflict with its Arab neighbours, that this was not Iran's purpose, that these Arab neighbours were Iran's brethren, and that Iran would not attack these neighbours, and that this was the decision of the interim council, provided no attacks were carried out against Iran from their territory. Now, I don't think this was actually intended by Pezeshkian to signal a decision by Iran to stop attacking American bases on the territories of the Gulf states. And very soon after Pezeshkian made his statement, when it became clear that the statement was being reported across the Western media as a statement that Iran was calling off its attacks on American bases in these countries, shortly after that, the Iranian military authorities, published their own statement saying that Iran would continue to strike American bases across the Middle East, wherever they were located, so long as the conflict, in other words, the attack on Iran by the United States and by Israel, was still underway. Now, Pezeshkian, it's important to remember, is within the Iranian political system at the far end of being a moderate. He was elected president of Iran in part on a platform to try to improve relations with the United States and with the West. This is his objective. This is what he promised the Iranian people he would try to do. And I've no doubt also that this is what, until very recently, he believes. He's also somebody who consistently takes a more conciliatory line than other Iranian leaders do, or than his predecessor as president of Iran, Ebrahim Raisi, once did. Pezeshkian, and it is important to say this, is not, by Iranian standards, a very experienced political operator. He is, I believe, a heart surgeon, apparently a very good one. He's somebody who has come out from outside the political system. His election win was seen at the time as something of an upset, and may, by the way, have been more related to his apparent endorsement of social changes within Iran itself, as opposed to foreign policy, just say. But anyway, it seems to me that he has never really known exactly how to shape his words to an ongoing crisis like the one that Iran is facing now. And he does, from time to time, slip out words which might imply that the Iranian position is softening, whereas the indications on the contrary are that it is not. It is also important to remember that, so far as one can judge, the Iranian official who is actually in charge of the conduct of the war itself, the person, in other words, who gives orders to the military and to the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, is not Pezeshkian. It is Ali Larijani, who is Khamenei's national security advisor, and who was apparently appointed by Khamenei after the January protests to take complete charge of Iran's armed forces and security services, which is the position he continues to occupy. If Larijani had made a statement about Iran ceasing attacks on the Gulf states, it's a statement I would have taken extremely seriously, coming from Pezeshkian, especially in a long speech, an address intended to project unity and defiance in the face of aggression, made over Iranian television. I have to say that I take it far less seriously and far less literally than some people in the West are doing. To repeat again, the Iranian military themselves are saying, as of the time of making of this program, that the attacks on American military bases across the Middle East will continue. Now, in saying all of this, it is important to say also that Pezeshkian is at the forefront of Iran's diplomatic efforts. He has spoken to various political leaders, and over the course of today, early today, he appears to have had a lengthy conversation with no less a person than President Putin of Russia. It greatly surprises me that this conversation is not being as widely reported in the Western media as it should be, especially in light of the revelation, or the claim, if you prefer, in the Washington Post, that Russia is currently providing important intelligence assistance, and for all I know also economic and other military aid to Iran. It's important to stress that that means that as of this time, assuming all that is true, as I believe, Putin and the Russians have leverage over Iran. Now, the Russians have provided a readout of this call between Pezeshkian and Putin, and I'm going to read it out in full. This is what the Russian readout says, the one published by the Kremlin. During the telephone conversation with President Pezeshkian, Putin once again expressed his heartfelt condolences on the assassination of Supreme Leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, his family members and the country's military and political leadership, as well as the numerous civilian casualties resulting from the United States and Israel's armed aggression against Iran. Of course, Putin has already written to Pezeshkian about all of this and has described in that letter the murder of Khamenei as a cynical, immoral and illegal act. Just say. Anyway, the Russian readout of the call then goes on to say this. Vladimir Putin reaffirmed Russia's principled stance in favour of an immediate cessation of hostilities. That's an interesting choice of words, because notice that the Russians are not talking about a ceasefire, but an immediate cessation of hostilities. This may sound like a play on words, but to me, the words cessation of hostilities imply more than a ceasefire, but rather a permanent end to all military action. In other words, a stop, a complete stop of the war and of all further attempts to overthrow the political system and government of Iran, a complete stop of all of that, not just now, but forever in the future. Just saying. It's important to remember that the Russians are extremely well known for choosing their words very carefully at this level of discussions. And then Putin continues, at least the readout says that he continued by saying that there should be, that Russia stood in favour of the rejection of force as a method to solve any issues surrounding Iran or arising in the Middle East, and a swift return to the path of diplomatic resolution. In this regard, the president of Russia noted that he was in constant contact with the leaders of the Gulf Cooperation Council member states, which suggests, by the way, that Putin was also conveying messages to Pezeshkian from the Saudis and the other Gulf states, and was acting in effect as a kind of honest broker between Iran and these countries. And then we continue to read from the Russian readout. Masoud Pezeshkian expressed gratitude for Russia's solidarity with the Iranian people as they defend their sovereignty and independence. Gratitude for Russia's solidarity? Might this be an admission of Russian aid? Possibly. Maybe one should not read too much into those words. And then we're further told that Pezeshkian also provided a detailed update on the developments during the latest active phase of the conflict. In other words, he updated Putin about the military situation, which might also imply, by the way, that the Russians are providing military aid of some kind to Iran. And then the Russian readout finishes. It was agreed that contact will be maintained with the Iranian side via various channels, which is interesting. And what channels might those be? I mean, not just apparently telephone conversations between Putin and Pezeshkian, not just diplomatic contacts. Could it be that there are Russian military and intelligence officers present in Iran itself, and that these are also providing a channel of communication, not just between the Russian and Iranian governments, but between the Russian and Iranian militaries and security services? All speculative, completely speculative, but then those words are there, and it seems to me that they do give rise to those sort of questions, because for the record, they're very, very rarely there in Russian readouts, unless some of the things that I've just been talking about, contacts between militaries, contacts between intelligence agencies, contacts between security services, might also be happening. Anyway, there it is. So the key takeaway from this readout is that the Russians are trying to broker what they call a cessation of hostilities. And notice that the two parties that the Russians are engaging in these discussions, are not the Americans and the Israelis on the one hand, and the Iranians on the other. It is a striking fact that Putin has not spoken to Trump at any point since the start of the American operation against Iran. In fact, he has not spoken to Trump since December, since the conversations that took place between Putin and Trump over the phone, which were interrupted by the Ukrainian drone attack, perhaps I should say the CIA Ukrainian drone attack on Putin's residence. It's a striking fact, which few people are noting, that Putin and Trump have not spoken since then. Trump has sometimes floated the idea that they might speak, and there is speculation that there have been unannounced conversations. Though for the record, I don't believe that this is the case. In fact, and in reality, as I believe, there have been no contacts at all. And in order to try to achieve this cessation of hostilities, Putin appears to be trying to broker some kind of agreement between Iran and the Gulf states. Now, here perhaps it's worth pointing out that one of the Gulf states, the UAE, as well as Iran, is a member of the BRICS, whilst Saudi Arabia, another country with very friendly relations with Russia, has been offered membership of the BRICS and has never given a clear answer of whether it believes itself to be a member of the BRICS or not. Though for the record, I personally consider that Saudi Arabia is not, at the present time, a member of the BRICS. So anyway, the Russians have close relations with the Gulf states, and obviously they have very close relations with Iran, and they appear to have made the decision that it is the Iranians and the Gulf states that they will speak to. They're not going to talk to Trump. They're not going to talk to the Americans. They don't trust the Americans. They consider that the Americans are totally out of their senses. They're not keen to speak to the Americans about Ukraine and the conflict in Ukraine either. And I will come to that later in this program. And though Putin has had one conversation since the start of the current war with Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel, who, by the way, according to rumours, isn't in Israel at all, but is currently in Berlin and has been there apparently for several days now, which begs many questions. Anyway, it seems that for the moment at least, the Russians are not particularly focused on the Israelis either, and they are disregarding the Americans entirely. And I'm going to suggest that this is what provides the explanation for Pezeshkian's words over the course of his television address. Now, the Iranians have provided their own readout of this call between Putin and Pezeshkian. And the readout, by the way, was interesting as well. And it seemed to me to be somewhat defensive. It was Putin speaking to the Iranians, to Pezeshkian, about the attacks by Iran on the Gulf states, and at least in part, Pezeshkian trying to justify those attacks. And I'll read out what the Iranians are saying. In a phone call with his Russian counterpart, President Putin, Pezeshkian discussed recent regional developments, condemning aggressive actions by the United States and Israel. The regimes in Washington and Israel started their unprovoked military assault on February 28th. Following the aggression, the leader of Iran, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, was assassinated. Iran began to retaliate swiftly against the criminal aggression by launching barrages of missiles and drone attacks on Israeli-occupied territories, as well as on US bases in regional countries. Pezeshkian denounced the unlawful assassination of Ayatollah Khamenei, calling it a breach of international law, and slammed, and this is apparently a direct quote, blind, ruthless powers for trying to impose their will on nations. And then there is a further apparent direct quote, the oppressors using blind and reckless force, trying to impose their will on nations, but the massive heroic support of the Iranian people for their system and country shows that these attacks only strengthen the nation's resolve to defend its homeland. And then the Iranian readout continues. Pezeshkian reminded Putin of earlier warnings that Israeli statements denying any intention to attack Iran were false, noting that it is evident to all that deceit and malice are their nature, and amid talks of negotiations, they have attacked us again. What Pezeshkian is referring to, and it is a big issue with the Russians, is an agreement that the Russians brokered with the Israelis, between Iran and the Israelis, back in December, that Iran and Israel would not attack each other. Pezeshkian appears to be telling Putin, look, we warned you when we made that agreement through your good offices and perhaps at your prompting with the Israelis that the Israelis would not honor it. And here you are, here we are, here you can see that our warnings to you were true. And obviously, for the Russians, that is something they can't really argue with and must feel extremely embarrassed about. And then elsewhere in this readout, Pezeshkian discussed with Putin the attacks on the US bases across the Middle East. Pezeshkian explained that any targeting of US military bases is purely defensive and is aimed at protecting Iran and its people, stressing that regional security must be ensured by the countries of the region, not by foreign forces. Rejecting rumors of an attack on Azerbaijan, he reiterated that Iran has never intended, nor will it ever intend, to attack neighboring states. And we have a direct quote. The Islamic Republic of Iran has never intended and will never intend to invade its neighbors. Our path is a strong defense of territorial integrity and lasting peace. So this, I think, provides the explanation for Pezeshkian's words. He came under pressure from Putin. Putin asked him, what are all these attacks on Dubai, on Qatar, on Bahrain, on Saudi Arabia, all about. I've got the leaders of all of these countries seething and furious with me about all of this. And Pezeshkian comes back and says to him, "Look, we're not in conflict with these countries, but we have been attacked, and we've been attacked by the United States, and these countries host American bases. So what do you expect us to do? We're not just going to sit back and allow ourselves to be attacked and not to respond by attacking these bases ourselves. But you can go back and tell the leaders of these countries that we are in no way seeking to conquer or invade or defeat them. We want good relations with them. What we feel we should work towards is a security architecture in which the peace of the region, of Iran and of the Gulf states, is decided by us, Iran and the Gulf states and the other Arab states, without requiring the involvement of external actors, first and foremost, the United States." And it seems to me that what happened is that coming straight out of this meeting with Putin, Pezeshkian tried to repeat the same message in his address to the Iranian people. This message for the Gulf states: look, we are not your enemies. We want to be your friends. Hosting these bases on your part was a mistake. Now we are at war. We have to defend ourselves, but we are not here to threaten you. And of course, lacking experience and probably under immense pressure, Pezeshkian muddled the way in which he explained what he needed to say. Now, briefly, is this diplomatic process that the Russians are currently engaged in going to work? I've been reading multiple reports about the extreme stress that the Gulf producers, including Saudi Arabia, are now under. And there have been more and more comments, not so much from the governments of these countries, but by business people now in these countries, expressing their absolute fury at the way in which they were catapulted into this war by decisions that they were unable to influence made in Washington and Israel. I was reading yesterday a furious statement made by one of the wealthiest businessmen of the Gulf, furiously angry with Donald Trump for initiating this war without properly taking into account the interests of these countries and failing to understand or having no heed to the consequences for these countries of the kind of war that President Trump has started. So I think that there is this feeling amongst the Gulf states, and I was reading in various places yesterday that the Gulf states are indeed reaching out in some way to Iran, and there's even reports that Saudi Arabia is now reaching out in some way to Iran to see whether some means to broker, to find a way out of this conflict might exist. And yesterday there were reports that Egypt and Pakistan are also putting themselves forward as mediators, though neither of these two countries obviously has the international weight and the influence over Iran and the Gulf states that Russia does. And it's perhaps worth pointing out that if Pakistan and Egypt, and by the way, Oman also, are acting as mediators, then by definition, this must be some kind of mediation process between the Gulf states and Iran to try to find some way out of this matter. And I have to say that trying to find a way through a peace agreement when you're only talking basically to one side, to Iran, and you're not really trying to find means to negotiate with the Americans and the Israelis, looks to me incredibly problematic. I can imagine a situation where the Arab states collectively come to some kind of understanding with Iran, an agreement with Iran, which they say should lead to a cessation of hostilities. But what if Donald Trump and the Israelis reject it? What if they say that they're going to continue the war? What if they continue strikes against Iran? What do the Arab states do then? There are some reports that some of the Arab states are now in discussions with each other about pulling their trillions of dollars of investment out of the US economy. I wonder whether that is even possible, just to say. And of course, the effect on the global economy would be colossal, and that effect would have to be borne upon these countries themselves. And, well, the United States would probably anyway take legal steps to prevent such disinvestment. Just to say, that billionaire that I spoke about pointed out, by the way, very bitterly, that the Gulf states have invested $1 billion each to join Trump's Board of Peace. And what was the point of doing all of that, given that the Gulf is now consumed by war? Very relevant points. The Gulf states, of course, could also do other things. They could make a decision to close down all the American bases and tell the Americans to leave. But let's say that the Americans agree to do that, and there might be some resistance. That would then leave the Arab Gulf states without a superpower patron and up against, or potentially up against, a far more powerful and very angry Iran. Iran, with perhaps some reason to believe that the Gulf states had colluded with the United States and Israel in the original attack upon Iran, on the assumption that Iran would quickly collapse. So the Gulf states, putting aside whatever they feel about the Americans, might in their own interests be unwilling to see the Americans completely leave. So I have to say that this complex negotiation that the Russians are engaging in doesn't seem to me very likely at the moment to lead to any immediate or short-term outcome. It's the sort of thing that might bear fruit over time if the war goes on, but I can't imagine that it will lead to a peace agreement in a week's time, or 2 weeks' time, or any proximate time for the moment. The key, as always, remains Iran's stability, its capacity to keep going. If, as I said, in 3, 4, 5, 6 months, Iran is still there and the United States finds itself in what might be, at that point, charitably referred to as a quagmire, debacle, geopolitical catastrophe, might be a more accurate word. Well, in that case, then, as I said, all of these diplomatic initiatives might bear fruit. But I've gone into some detail discussing this in order to explain President Pezeshkian's words and why I think that they have been overinterpreted. They are the product of a conversation that Pezeshkian came from immediately before he spoke to the Iranian people. A conversation he had with President Putin. Now, Donald Trump, of course, has not done this exercise which I just have. He, on the contrary, has written a true social post in which he takes these words of Pezeshkian far beyond even their most, shall we say, optimistic from an American point of view reading. He says that Iran has surrendered to the Gulf states. This, based on a speech by Pezeshkian, in which Pezeshkian said that Iran would never surrender, and disregarding the message from the Iranian military that attacks on the American bases will continue. So Trump says that Iran has surrendered, that Iran is a loser, that Iran for the first time in I can't remember how many thousands of years has supposedly been defeated in a war. Not true, by the way. Iran was defeated during the Second World War when it was invaded by Britain and the Soviet Union. A rather ghastly business in many respects, though I think given the realities of that war, also a necessary one, not one I'm going to discuss in this program. Anyway, just saying. So Iran, according to Trump, has been defeated by him and by the United States for the first time in 1,000, 2,000, 4,000, whatever it was, years. Iran has surrendered, and it's all because of him and because the United States is hitting Iran hard, and the United States is going to hit Iran harder still. And, well, on that, we have reports that a third US Navy carrier, the George H.W. Bush, is now steaming towards the Arabian Sea to join the other two carriers, the Lincoln and the Ford. I've seen some suggestions that the true purpose of the Bush is to take over from the Ford, which has been at sea for far longer than is usually usual for a carrier, and which is as a result suffering from various equipment and other problems. But I'm not going to discuss all of that. And Trump, of course, repeats that now that the Iranians are down, this isn't the moment to slacken off. There's going to be another even bigger attack on Iran over the next few hours than any attack we have seen up to now. Now, I would point out that the Americans have talked about this. They've said this kind of thing before. They've said in the past that they were going to, over the course of this war, that they were going to conduct an even bigger, mightier, more powerful attack than the attacks that they have inflicted. But I have to say this, that has not been my overall impression. It seems to me that the Americans can do indeed conduct attacks, but they also have perhaps reached their limit on what they can do in terms of scale. And, well, I doubt that these blows, each one by itself, can act as a knockout blow. If Iran is going to break, it is not because of one big knockout blow. It is because of the cumulative effect of the many blows that Iran is receiving. And of course, Iran will continue to conduct strikes of its own. They've made that very clear, as I said, over the course of the last few hours. They continue to launch missiles at Israel. Some of their regional allies are now joining them. Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Houthi militia in Yemen has not yet joined the battle, but is now giving indications that it might do so. There's conflicts all over the Middle East. There is massive uncertainty about what the Kurds are going to do or not do. Iran continues to strike at Kurdish militia in Iraq. The member of the Iranian community, of the Duran community, who calls himself Iranian Kiddo, has very usefully provided in a recent live stream a description of the various Kurdish groups in Iraqi Kurdistan. He says that there's four of them, of whom only one appears to be closely associated with the United States and Israel. The aggregate number of these forces, these militias command, is around 8,000. The best trained militia, the one that is closest to Israel and the United States, which is made up of dissident Kurds from Iran itself, that may be the militia that the official, the fellow of the Royal United Services Institute was discussing in the article in the Daily Telegraph that I discussed yesterday. That militia perhaps numbers around 1,500 men. And I said in my previous program that that does not seem to me to be a sufficient force to take on Iran. There are also lots of reports that Azerbaijan might be thinking of some kind of operation against Iran. Azerbaijan has closed its embassy in Tehran. They claimed that an Iranian drone or missile attacked facilities within Azerbaijan itself. Putin asked Pezeshkian over the course of the telephone conversation, which I discussed earlier in the program, what that was all about. Pezeshkian, of course, said that Iran has no plan to attack Azerbaijan. It would make no sense for Iran to do so, by the way. The Russians will not be pleased if Azerbaijan were to join some kind of military operation against Iran. Not being pleased is an understatement. They have considerable leverage over Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan is dependent on oil exports. The pipelines that export the Russian oil, the Azerbaijanian oil, pass through territory controlled by Russia. The Russians can turn off the pipelines, as, by the way, they briefly did last year. And, of course, I've also received what I believe to be true reports from Russia, that the Russians have instituted criminal cases against key Azerbaijanian leaders and have prepared indictments against them for various organized crime activities on Russian territory. And the Russians have also been concentrating troops close to Azerbaijan itself. Anyway, I don't want to anticipate what may happen there. But anyway, all of these things remain, for the moment, uncertain. The key thing is that the United States and Israel continue to hammer Iran. Iran continues to launch strikes across the Middle East against Israel and against American bases. But the Straits of Hormuz remains closed, and oil prices continue to increase. Now, E. Smith of Naked Capitalism has provided me with a brilliant and very interesting article by a commentator called Shanaka Anslem Pereira on Substack. He talks about the invisible siege, how insurance markets, not missiles, closed the Straits of Hormuz. And I'm going to briefly, very briefly, summarize this article, or my understanding of this article. It's very technical in places, and as Eve Smith rightly says, it's clear that the person who's written it understands, knows what he's talking about. Anyway, this article says that given the mere threat, the mere possibility of an attack on tankers trying to pass the Straits of Hormuz, all of the big insurers are going to pull insurance from these tankers, because the insurance markets, the maritime insurance markets for this kind of naval traffic, are massively depleted, very hollowed out already, because of the heavy insurance payouts last year following the attacks on shipping in the Red Sea. And the loss of a single tanker, if it were authorized to pass through the Straits of Hormuz, would open insurers to costs of $200 million, which they simply cannot afford, given the realities of the markets at this time, the insurance markets and the depths of the insurance markets at this time. And this article continues by saying that because of the risks, even if the Straits of Hormuz were to reopen tomorrow, and there were to be a cessation of hostilities, the mechanics of getting insurance working again and of getting the ships to move might themselves be protracted. And that on top of everything else, the brittleness in the insurance industry also leads to wider risks for the entire global financial system. Now, yesterday on the Duran, we did a live stream in which our two guests, Alex of Reportify and Cyrus Jansen, discussed the very significant risks to the global financial system if markets insure. From this crisis, they didn't discuss the insurance position specifically, but, well, you could see how all of these things start to tie together. Now, I am not myself an expert in these matters, but I will say that, to my knowledge, every single instance where the price of oil has got out of control has led to a crisis in the financial markets. The 2008 crisis was in part at least precipitated by the fact that the oil price went above $150 a barrel, as I very well remember. So if oil prices reach those elevated levels, then especially at a time when there are already concerns about the state of global financial markets, well, I would be very worried indeed. But anyway, we shall see. Now, for the moment, the president, as I said, he gives me sometimes the impression that he really, well, I'm not the impression, I get the sense of certainty that he doesn't know where this whole operation is going. One gets a sense that he and his, I'm going to call him defense secretary, I found the whole war secretary business nonsensical, Pete Hegseth, are making it up as they go along. The president speaks sometimes about wanting regime change. Other times he talks otherwise. He talks about unconditional surrender and of choosing Iran's leader and grandly of overthrowing the government of Cuba as well. At other times he says that Iran can preserve its present system and it can continue to be a dictatorship, as he describes it, with a religious leader, but this person should be fair to Israel. A comment which I don't completely anyway understand, just to say, there continue to be more and more reports that munitions, that the key munitions, the Tomahawk missiles and the Patriot missiles, the stockpiles are running low. I read in the same article by Mr. Pereira that I've just discussed that the Tomahawk missile stockpile before the start of the war had already reduced, this is the usable stockpile, had already reduced to just 1,000 Tomahawk missiles, that wear and tear issues, maintenance problems, and overuse of Tomahawks in various other conflicts, especially the one with the Houthis last year, has depleted the Tomahawk missile stockpile significantly. All of the problems, all of the pressures that I discussed in many programs are still there. And for the record, I think the president's latest words, seizing on these comments by President Pezeshkian, saying that Iran is surrendering and that this is the time to hit them even harder, that this is symptomatic of a man who is clutching at straws. It also appears to be the case that the president himself is increasingly retreating into what you might describe as a bunker. Apparently, he's forbidden his vice president, J.D. Vance, from conducting any public meetings, which is extraordinary. He doesn't speak to officials who are sceptical about this conflict. He is increasingly restricting his discussions to a tiny group of a very, very hardline people, and he's increasingly quarrelling with the US's allies, with Britain, with Spain, with France now also, with all of them as well. His plan, to the extent that he has one, seems to me to do the same thing again and again and again and wait for a positive result and keep fingers crossed and hope that everything comes right and Iran collapses before the financial markets collapse and the oil price spirals out of control and the Democrats win the midterms and the US military itself finds its weapon stockpiles so depleted that it cannot keep the battle against Iran going on at the same tempo anymore. It's not a strategy. It's not a plan, not in any sense. It's a gamble. It's winging it along. But for the moment, at least, Trump seems too deeply committed to pull back. Well, there we are. That's the end of my commentary about the Iran conflict today. On the oil issue, again, demonstrating the extraordinary confusion that there is. I've seen lots of reports that India, which is now increasingly buying oil from Russia once more, that India asked the United States for a license to do that, so that the tariffs that the US had previously threatened against India should not apply. That's how it's been reported across the media. What I've heard is something rather different, that India just went ahead and started to buy more Russian oil, and the United States, which is now desperate to keep the oil markets open, lamely announced that it had granted India the license to do it. It's very important to keep a level head and not to assume that every report that you see in the media is true, though I don't pretend again to be completely well informed about this story. Meanwhile, the US Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, who's supposed to be going to China to prepare for President Trump's own visit to China at the end of this month. One wonders whether that will take place. Anyway, Scott Bessent said that he's going to tell the Chinese to stop buying Russian oil and to buy American oil instead. He cannot seriously believe that the Chinese will agree to do anything like that, especially when they're reading all over the media in the West that part of the purpose of this whole operation against Iran is to cut off supplies of oil to China, just a sec. But anyway, here we have the Americans saying that they're actually going to start easing sanctions on the Russian oil trade altogether and granting licensing to India to buy more Russian oil, even as they come along and supposedly are going to tell the Chinese to stop buying Russian oil as well. It's chaos and confusion. Those who pretend to find some plan or pattern to this, well, all I can say is if they think that there is a plan here, perhaps they can tell me what it is, because I can't see it. Anyway, let me now turn to what the Russians have been saying about the conflict in Ukraine. And here, by the way, very briefly, I should say that there were significant Russian advances yesterday, especially close to Slavyansk, and the Russians conducted a sizable combined drone and missile strike against Ukraine yesterday. Though not yet on the scale of some of the other attacks that we have seen. But over the last 2 days, on the 5th of March to be precise, the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, actually entered into a lengthy discussion about the situation in Ukraine. And he said some very interesting things about the ongoing negotiations. We are actively engaged in negotiations with our American counterparts who are facilitating dialogue with Ukraine. Several trilateral rounds have recently been held in Abu Dhabi. We're sincerely grateful to our Emirati friends and Geneva. At present, we discern no grounds to suspect that these negotiations are a smokescreen, as we remain in direct contact with our American colleagues. However, Are political scientists, analysts, public figures and members of parliament, who by definition are not part of this closed process, have begun drawing parallels and questioning how these talks might continue. And what Lavrov is referencing here is American duplicity in starting the attack on Iran whilst negotiations with Iran are taking place. Some Russian political scientists, analysts, public figures, and members of parliament are saying, how can we continue to conduct negotiations with the Americans when the way the Americans conducted the negotiations with Iran show that the Americans cannot be trusted? Anyway, Lavrov then continues, they, that's to say these political scientists, analysts, public figures and members of parliament, assert that the actions of the United States have shattered the spirit of Anchorage. I have already addressed this topic. In Anchorage, the spirit was far from the most significant event. The spirit refers to the atmosphere, and it was comradely, mutually respectful and constructive. But the spirit evaporates. The principal achievement of Anchorage was not the spirit. We know how adept our Western colleagues are at creating an atmosphere, but I repeat, the spirit evaporates. The crux of Anchorage lay in the concrete understanding reached on the basis of proposals put forward by President Trump and his negotiating team. President Putin has repeatedly remarked that we accepted these proposals, including those aspects that represented a significant compromise from us. We proceed from what was offered to us, which we accepted. That is the current benchmark in these negotiations with the American side. We are acutely aware that in the 7 months since Anchorage, Ukraine and the Europeans have exerted and continue to exert every effort to reinterpret and rewrite the understanding reached in Anchorage. We observe how negotiators in the United States are subject to this pressure and the temptation to yield to it, shifting the responsibility for further steps, as they phrase it, onto Russia, in order to meet certain symbolic dates in this year's political calendar. This too is a fact, but our conscience is clear. We remain faithful to the understandings clearly achieved at the proposal of the United States in Anchorage. So what does all this, these very complex and strange language, tell us? Well, the first point to say is that this is an official Russian admission from a senior official of the Russian government, Sergei Lavrov, that the entire Anchorage process, the entire process of negotiations with the United States, is coming inside Russia in for sustained criticism. I've discussed this many times. I've discussed how Putin has been out on a limb in persisting with these negotiations, and Lavrov is practically telling us as much, that more and more people, Maybe they're not party to the negotiations, but they are important people. They include members of parliament. They include political scientists, analysts, all of those people. They're coming and saying, what is the point of these negotiations? The Americans cannot be trusted. They haven't delivered on what they promised. They never will. They deceived the Iranians, and they're deceiving us. So Lavrov has admitted that. And he's also saying something else, that the goodwill of the Anchorage summit has dissipated. He says that the spirit of Anchorage has evaporated. He says that the Russians no longer have the same feelings of goodwill towards the Americans that they had in the immediate aftermath of that meeting. But Lavrov also says that putting aside the atmospherics, a specific agreement between Russia and the United States was reached in Anchorage. The Russians have never told us what that agreement is, and to the extent that we can work out, than the various many public statements that the Russians have made, that agreement, in essence, was some form of acceptance by the United States of Russian demands of what we on the Duran call Istanbul Plus, though with some unspecified compromise from the Russian side, a compromise which, as I've discussed in many programs, I cannot myself work out what it was. Lavrov is saying that there is no goodwill any further. There is little actual progress. Russia is sticking to the proposal that the Americans made and the at Anchorage and before Anchorage, and the agreement that was made then, that the Russians are not prepared to compromise any further. They insist on that agreement being honoured, whatever that agreement was, perhaps the agreement leading to Istanbul Plus. Now, there's many ways of interpreting these words of Lavrov, but I think that this is the most logical one. It suggests to me very strongly that the Russians have now, and for some time in fact, reached the end point in the negotiating process. They've set out what their position is. It is for the Americans to deliver on what they promised, and for the Ukrainians to agree to it. Until that happens, the war goes on. In a few weeks, when the Rasputitsa ends, the Russian offensive will begin. We'll see whether by that point, depending what happens in the Middle East, President Trump and the people in Europe have any bandwidth to think about that. Zelensky himself is now very, very upset that all of the attention has moved from him. It could very well be that over the course of the summer, the Russians wrap up their offensive in Ukraine, capture the cities of Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, and perhaps Zaporozhye too, and nobody in the West is paying much attention. Anyway, that's my understanding of Lavrov's words. This is where I finish my program today. Let me remind you again, you know, to check all our platforms. You can find all our videos on all our platforms, Locals, Rumble, X, Substack. You can also support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video, Last but not least, please remember, if you've liked this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.